Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with political writers Jonathan Alter and Christopher Caldwell. Each has written an essay for us on the state of modern politics.
I would say that in their complexity, though not their severity, Obama had an even harder time than Franklin Roosevelt in 1933.
The Tea Party believes that they are the representatives of the middle class. And I think the Codevilla book is this case made at its clearest.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. That's coming up after the break.
The Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature. And by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 Assist to give you peace of mind.
With possibly historic midterm elections upon us, the New York Times Book Review asked two important political journalists, each to write an essay for us. Jonathan Alter of Newsweek assessed the current state of liberalism, and Christopher Caldwell of the Weekly Standard and the Financial Times assessed the state of conservatism. And now we're going to talk about it all. Chris, let me start with you. This looks like it could be a resurgent moment for the Republican Party. But as you write in your essay, the party has to deal with another party, the Tea Party insurgents. What is at stake for Republicans and conservatism as these two factions or institutions look at one another?
Yes, there are a lot of parties to this election. Conservatism seems to be in very good shape. People like it. That recent Gallup poll I mentioned in my article in which conservatives outnumber liberals among likely voters by 3-1. That's a good sign for conservatives. The problem is that none of this has seemed to budge distrust in which the general public holds the Republican Party. And that distrust seems to be very strong even within the Tea Party movement. And that means that should the Republicans win a lot of seats in November, they're going to have a big discussion about who they are and why the public still doesn't like them. And that will probably mean evolving in a more Tea Party-esque direction.
And Jonathan Alter, your essay on liberalism also describes a kind of conflict between pragmatic Democrats and progressives. What's the difference between these two groups?
Well, I kind of think of it as the difference between what I call action liberals and movement liberals. Action liberals are pragmatists. They want to get things done. They don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good, as President Obama puts it. So they'll take half a loaf or a quarter a loaf if that provides some important, if incremental, change. What I call movement liberals, more liberal liberals, they have a real record of accomplishment over the last century because it's movements that propel major change in the United States. But they have a purity in their thinking about the members of the Democratic Party who make the pragmatic compromises that are a part of politics. So you have this enthusiasm gap, as it's being called this fall, where the Democratic base doesn't think that President Obama has done what they had hoped. And even though I would argue he's actually accomplished quite a bit, there's little appreciation for it in the Democratic Party, and I think that will tamp down turnout this fall.
Chris, there appears to be no shortage of enthusiasm on the right. What specific ideas or programs might the Tea Party introduce that would enliven or revive the Republican Party as most people in the middle think of it?
As far as programs are concerned, I mean, one thing that I think has been very wise electorally, but it's very frustrating to people who are trying to analyze the Republican program, is that Republicans have not been very detailed about the biggest problem that confronts us, or what they say is the biggest problem, which is the budget deficit. There have not been clear ideas of what is going to be cut. But I think the biggest idea behind this movement, the idea that's uniting discontented people all across the country, I think is constitutionalism. I think it's the idea that, in a way, the levers of government have been moved too far away from the people. And if indeed that is the problem that's being diagnosed, fixing it is a very complicated and involves a great deal of reform and huge change. So if the Republicans are going to make a major change in that direction, it's going to be bigger than we even anticipate.
John, if Obama is to recapture the excitement of his early days in office, does he have to win back the movement Democrats, or have they really deserted him for good?
Well, when you're president, nothing is for good until the very end of a second term. You can reinvent yourself depending on events and how you react to those events. And it's important to never underestimate the power of the bully pulpit and the ability of a president to make course corrections. I don't think that he needs to start pandering to the left in order to come back politically if he takes a shellacking in the midterm elections. I also don't think that he should follow, you know, Bill Clinton's pattern after the 1994 midterm fiasco for Democrats and triangulate by moving abruptly to the center. He needs to find some new approach that does find some common ground with Republicans when they have more of a responsibility to govern if they take control of the House. I think the Senate is much less likely for them to win. And I think he's going to want to work with them on education, perhaps immigration, perhaps energy, and find some common ground that is beyond a kind of a left-right divide. And they'll have a big fight over the funding of the health care bill. So you will see some vetoes, presumably. But I don't think that he thinks that becoming, a full-throated populist is the way for him to go, or consistent with either his true feelings or his political needs going into a 2012 reelection campaign.
John, in your essay, you discuss a wealth of new books written by liberals or from the left. One or two in particular that you found really enlightening that readers might want to spend some time with?
Well, Winner Take All Politics by Pearson and Hacker is, I think, a really good summary of what's happened to our country economically, where the top 1% has had more than 35% of the gains in household income in recent years. That's a stunning statistic. There's been this huge wealth transfer from the middle class to the wealthy. Right now, the American people aren't mad about it, and it might be that because everybody in our country wants to be wealthy, they never get mad about it. But it is, I would argue, warping our politics. And you can see from the 9-to-1 advantage that Republicans have in the current campaign on independent expenditures, corporate and wealthy interests pouring money into these campaigns, that there's an effort to buy politicians on behalf of corporate America and wealthy interests. And so the question is whether the Democrats can mobilize the abandoned middle class to fight more for its own interests with perhaps some new ideas, not necessarily all the old-time religion. And you can see this with the president moving against the teachers' unions, for instance, on education, to not be necessarily trapped in all of the ideas of the past, but to focus on this question of a disappearing middle class. If the Democrats can't get that connection back, they're going to have trouble winning elections, even though the demographics of this country are moving strongly in the favor of liberal Democrats.
Chris, in your essay, you discuss in some detail the cultural divides between the elites in American politics and society and the mainstream. Was there one book in particular that seemed to state this argument in a coherent or compelling way?
Yes. There's a book by a fellow named Angelo Codevilla. It's called The Ruling Class, How They Corrupted America and What We Can Do About It. This book is a short, conservative, polemic. I think that people who don't have any sympathy for Codevilla's views will dislike it. But those who do have some sympathy will find it a real breath of fresh air. But I think, you know, Jonathan's just been talking about the problem of elites and of elite concentration of power and how liberals need to find a way to take the side of the middle class. It's very interesting that on the right, and I don't know that this is the view of all of the Republican Party, but I certainly think that the Tea Party believes that they are the representatives of the middle class, that the Democrats are the representatives of the elite. And I think the Codevilla book is this case made at its clearest.
And what is the case he makes?
Well, it's partly an oratorical case, that the language in which American politics is discussed tends to demean middle-class people as either fundamentalist, religious, racist, lackeys to business, or in some other way not being capable of exercising the franchise in a responsible way. But there's also an interesting institutional case, which has to do with centralization of power. And he brings up an interesting statistic that 70 years ago, say in 1940, when America had 130 million people in it, Americans could vote on over 100,000 school boards. Today, you know, now that the country is almost three times as large, we have about a sixth as many school boards to vote on. So all institutions are becoming more and more distant from the people, whether or not they're removed from the people in the name of democratic ideology or republican ideology, things are becoming more centralized. And to that extent, the people's voice is being heard less and less.
John, is America simply harder to govern now than it was a generation or two ago? You wrote an important book on the first 100 days of the New Deal, and you've written a bestseller about Obama's first term, or as much of it as we've seen. Is Obama's job harder than Franklin Roosevelt's was?
Well, the country's not in as bad shape as it was when Roosevelt took office, when the official unemployment rate was 25% and, you know, the real rate was probably over 40%. So we were at the depths of the Depression. In that sense, Roosevelt had a harder task at the beginning. But in making some progress in getting out of a depression, he got a lot more credit, even though we didn't get fully out until the huge government spending of World War II. An interesting lesson in what actually does return an economy to economic growth. It's not tax cuts. In the only experience we've had, it's massive government spending. But Roosevelt at the beginning did not have to deal with both domestic and foreign issues. And Obama did, right from the start. The situation on the ground in Afghanistan was deteriorating by the day. He had a hugely complex problem with Iran moving toward nuclear weapons, as well as a whole series of complexities in trying to put a tourniquet on the bleeding economy. We were losing 750,000 jobs a month when he took office. So I would say that in their complexity, though not their severity, Obama had an even harder time than Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. And interestingly, during the transition from Hoover to Roosevelt, Roosevelt decided that he didn't really want to participate, and he went out on Vincent Astor's yacht, you know, and kind of left. Whereas Obama was making $100 billion decisions almost every day. And we forget that the stimulus, which passed quite quickly, was a huge piece of legislation that did all kinds of things that haven't gotten any attention, like doubling medical and scientific research, for instance, investing in the economy in the country in ways that haven't been commented on much. And they were making these big decisions at very high speed. Now, you can say, well, maybe they shouldn't have done that. They should have waited. But they felt that there wasn't time to wait, that it was going to take long enough for the spending to begin to take effect anyway, and they needed to get it passed as quickly as possible. So they sacrificed some things with their emphasis on speed. But those early days, there was so much going on. And I would argue, I guess, in some ways, you have to really go back to Lincoln trying to deal with a country that was pulling apart in his early days to find a president who had the sheer complexity that Obama faced.
Chris, is the Tea Party soon or eventually going to be absorbed into the Republican Party the way the insurgencies under Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan in 1976 were, where in a sense it was a wing of the Republican Party that then gained preeminence or control? Is that what we're seeing now?
That's right, yes. I think that that is more like it, because there are different ways to get it absorbed into a larger party. You can just sort of learn to walk the walk and talk the talk, or you can make reform a condition for your continued allegiance. I think at this point, it's the Republican Party that needs what the Tea Party has. So I think you're going to see probably more focus on budget balancing, although, as I say, I think Republicans are still very vague on how they're going to do that. I think you'll see more support for returning certain functions to states and local communities, and that's another area where it's hard to see how it will work out in practice. But the ideology of the Republican Party, I think, is going to change.
Jonathan Alter, one last question for you. There was so much grassroots activism at the time Obama was elected, a lot of it on the internet. Where is all that now?
Well, I think there was some fatigue after the election, and then there was some disillusionment, and people went back to their busy lives. Personal feelings for Barack Obama are still fairly high. He's respected. It's not like the bottom has fallen out of his support. And at 45%, he's roughly comparable to where Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan were at this time in their tenures. But he's got to figure out a way to reconnect and reignite the base. You see him trying to in the last weeks before the midterms. We'll see how successful that is. His big problem, I think, is that he overlearned the lesson that Mario Cuomo used to teach, which is that you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. So he figured, okay, the campaign's over. It's time to govern, and I'll throw all the poetry out the window. And he needs to recognize that you have to govern in poetry as well if you're going to maintain your base.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan Alter and Christopher Caldwell.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay. Thanks.
Coming up, Jennifer Schussler talks to Julie Bosman, who has this week's Notes from the Field.
The Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. One audiobook to consider is The Glass Room by Simon Maugham. The story of a young Jewish couple in 1930s Czechoslovakia, his latest novel combines struggle and faith in a way the Washington Post describes as eerily erotic and tremendously exciting. That's The Glass Room, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jenny.
So what's going on out there this week?
This week we've had some big news at Random House. They have reached into the magazine industry world for the second time in a month. They've hired John Meacham, the former Newsweek editor, to take a big job as an executive editor and executive vice president. And he'll be acquiring books on his own, editing books, as well as writing a couple of them.
So Meacham, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Andrew Jackson. He's written a number of books. How's he going to do all of this stuff at one time? What are his other projects?
Well, Meacham, of course, was the Newsweek editor. He was there for about 15 years, and he left this summer after the Washington Post Company sold the magazine to Sidney Harman, the audio pioneer and arts philanthropist. But since then, Meacham really hasn't had a full-time job. He's been working on his own books. He has a Jefferson biography that he's working on at the moment. And he also is the host of a PBS show called Need to Know. But he'll be starting at Random House in January. And I imagine that he'll juggle his editing, acquiring, writing duties. He's working on the Jefferson biography right now. And after that, he'll be doing a biography of George H.W. Bush.
Number 41, he's kind of coming to the end of the line. Maybe he's hoping for a change of regime in 2012, so he'll have another president to write about.
Yes, he's running out of presidents. He's already covered Andrew Jackson, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and who knows who'll be next.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Jenny.
The Book Review Podcast is brought to you by Ford and Voice Activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 Assist. If your airbag deploys, Sync automatically calls 911 using your cell phone and puts you in contact with a 911 operator. Sync will even deliver an urgent message to the emergency operator if you can't respond. That's peace of mind made possible by Sync. Sync is subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Jennifer Schuessler's here with Bestseller News. What's new on the list this week, Jenny?
We do have some new titles. There's a new number one on the fiction list, Vince Flynn's latest thriller. It's called American Assassin. He topples Michael Connelly, who drops down to number four. And Jonathan Franzen seems to be slipping. Freedom falls to number six this week. It was at number three last week. So we'll see if he can hang on until his date with Oprah. Over on the nonfiction list, a bunch of new books. Jon Stewart climbs back to number one with his book Earth. There are a lot of biographies and autobiographies that are new this week. We've got Mickey Mantle at number four. He's the subject of Jane Levy's The Last Boy. Down at number nine, we've got Condoleezza Rice's Extraordinary Ordinary People about her childhood and her parents. Nelson Mandela's Conversations with Myself at number 10. And my favorite, Rick Springfield's Late, Late at Night down at number 13.
You recently wrote about another bestseller list of a kind, the one that covers old out-of-print books. What's going on there?
The online used book retailer Bookfinder.com, which is basically a search engine that aggregates lots of used booksellers, every year they release this list of the most searched for out-of-print books, which I always find fascinating. I love old books. I love old bookstores. And this is sort of gives a little bit of insight into what the American people really want to read about but have difficulty because these books are out of print. And this list has also kind of become a crib sheet for publishers who want to find titles that they can bring back into print and maybe make a little bit of money off of. And there have been some pretty spectacular bestsellers minted from this. For instance, last year, Once a Runner, this sort of cult novel about running, published in 1978, essentially self-published by John Parker. It had been on the list almost every year for 10 years. It was brought back into print, and it actually made the New York Times hardcover fiction list. Quite remarkable for a book originally published in 1978. And if you look at this year's list, there are some books that are definitely not going to be coming back into print anytime soon. Madonna's Sex, it's number one. It's number one every year. Then there's Lynn Cheney's Sisters, her sort of quasi-lesbian bodice ripper historical novel.
This is Lynn Cheney, the wife of Dick Cheney,
yes,
and former head of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Yes, and apparently a practiced romance novelist. And this is a book that's not going to see the light of day anytime soon. But there's a lot of that kind of sexy stuff. But one very noticeable trend is how many how-to books there are. And it seems to kind of reflect a sort of particular recession mentality. For example, there are titles like Ship Ashore, Adventures in Salvage. Apparently, lots of people want to get their hands on this book. The Lovely Reed, An Enthusiast's Guide to Building Bamboo Fly Rods. And then there's my favorite, Too Good to Be Through, The Complete Operations Manual for Resale and Consignment Shops.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.